It is Monday morning, as I'm sure you're well aware out there in Radio Land, September 19th, and it is time for your KDNK local newscast. Between August 26th and September 8th, Carbondale Police responded to 562 calls for service. KDNK's Amy Haddon-Marsh has this week's Eye on Crime.
The Carbondale PD made 10 arrests between August 26th and September 8th, including two DUIs on Friday, September 2nd, one from a sobriety checkpoint at the intersection of Highway 133 and Village Road. On August 28th, a 23-year-old Carbondale man fled the scene of a one-car accident at the roundabout. According to the police press log, the driver damaged town property. In an email correspondence between Carbondale Police Chief Gene Schilling and Town Trustee Frosty Marriott, Schilling said that the driver's insurance company had been in contact with town officials and that there should be no repair costs to the town. The driver was cited for careless driving and leaving the scene of an accident. Police were called to the scene of another accident on September 6th, where a Carbondale man was arrested for DUI and careless driving. Other arrests included one for harassment, disorderly conduct, and domestic violence, a minor in possession of marijuana, one for an outstanding warrant, and one for criminal mischief, harassment, and resisting arrest. Also on September 6th, a woman reported losing money to an IRS phone scam. She said she was told that if she didn't pay $2,000, she would be arrested. She apparently paid the money with purchased iTunes cards, and the phone number ended up being a fake. On Wednesday, September 7th, officers took a report from the County Department of Human Services of a possible child abuse case, which is under investigation. And the Carbondale PD has not yet identified or located a man who attacked an adult woman just after midnight on July 23rd near Highway 133 and Village Road. The attacker was described as a Hispanic male, about 5 feet 5, around 40 years old. Initial DNA test results from the Colorado Bureau of Investigation were inconclusive, but comparisons are ongoing. According to a recent press release from the Carbondale PD, no other similar attacks have been reported, and officers have stepped up patrols in outlying areas. And finally, the Colorado Secretary of State warns of another fraud, automated calls about incorrect voter registration and asking for personal information seem to be coming from an organization calling itself Go Vote Colorado or Go Vote CO, which sounds similar to the state's legitimate online voter registration system. According to a press release issued last week, the Secretary of State does not contact voters about voter registration issues except to respond to inquiries initiated by the voter. That's it for this week's Eye on Crime. Colorado has one of the highest rates of opioid abuse in the country. State and federal officials are asking Congress for more money to expand public awareness and hire more healthcare workers. Benta Berkland reports.
Democratic Congresswoman Diana DeGette says there is bipartisan support in Washington on the need, but so far the money isn't there. She's proposing another $500 million be spent on opioid abuse programs to help people get off the drugs.
It's a very one-on-one expensive process because opioids change the chemistry of the brain. Most of them are going to need very intensive therapy.
Health officials say the success rate of quitting cold turkey without medication to help is only 15%, and that's among people with intact families who are employed and have a place to live. The state is also getting input currently from the public on how it prescribes and dispenses opioids. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
Living off the grid in Colorado's vast San Luis Valley, Chuck and Barbara Tidd needed to find a source of energy to supplement their solar panels. Their solution to use a creek on the property to generate power led to a legal battle that went all the way to the Colorado Supreme Court, where they won. That decision worries some who say that Tidd's new right could upend water law that goes back 150 years.
The San Luis Valley in southern Colorado is immense. It's a basin about 125 miles long, sitting right in the middle of the Rocky Mountains.
Despite being at high altitude, the valley has a desert feel. It typically only gets a few inches of precipitation a year, and in fact, one of its most famous attractions are sand dunes.
In the spring, snowmelt from the adjacent peaks drains into the valley, and much of that runoff soaks into the soil to fill shallow aquifers, making it ideal for agriculture.
But there's only so much water to go around, and a claim to it can pit neighbor against neighbor, as it did in the case of Barbara and Chuck Tidd.
It's their situation that brought us to their home to hear what happened. and how their victory might have turned 150 years of water law on its head.
Okay, hi, how are you?
I'm Franny.
This is Franny.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Franny. And this is Jeepers and Cruiser.
Hi, Jeepers. Hi, Cruiser.
Yeah, welcome right in.
The Tids live in a house they built on the valley slope that would make you drool. A wide panorama from their living room takes in the sweep of the basin, and you could swear you see New Mexico, some 70 miles away.
Even as we talk, a pronghorn antelope strolls below their deck and stops to stare in our direction, as if on cue to show off the amazing natural beauty Chuck and Barbara enjoy.
You could say they have it all, but at the same time, you'd have to say they've got nothing.
We're way too far off grid to make it even feasible to run power lines. When we started building, it was $100,000 just to run the wires up here, and I'm sure it's a whole lot more than that now.
So they're on their own, getting drinking water from springs.
And their electricity from a solar array. But when it gets cloudy, they need something else to keep the lights on and appliances humming.
Their answer? Hydro. They came up with an idea to generate power from an irrigation ditch that runs through their property.
Only problem, the ditch belonged to someone else.
Creek that runs through our property is actually a ditch that belongs to the Freeze family down the hill, and they irrigate with the water.
The Freeze are cattle ranchers who grow hay with their water, and they were none too pleased with the Tids' plan to generate power or how they went about it.
My understanding, incorrect understanding, was, oh, you start working on it, then you file. Wrong. Chuck started like digging and, you know, he was going to lay some pipe, and then he called the irrigators up to take a look at it, and they said, don't touch my ditch.
Welcome to Colorado water law, known as the prior appropriation system, that basically says first in time, first in right. It started back in early gold mining days and essentially allowed the first guys in to dibs water in a stream before anyone else could use it.
Even though all the Tids wanted to do was run water through a pipe to generate power and return every drop, this was no simple undertaking.
For starters, they had to file an application for a water right with the state.
But the irrigators, they objected.
The case went to water court. Yes, this complex arrangement has its own legal system, and the judge agreed with the Tids. They could use the water to generate power as long as they did no harm to the downstream users.
The ranchers were not happy. They took the case all the way to the Colorado Supreme Court, arguing that the Tids could not use the water because it already belonged to them, and they should have the right to use it before anyone else. But is that really what the law states?
Water can be used for many uses. It's a usufructory right to use that water, it's meaning you don't own it. They use the term, use the molecules of water before anybody else does, you know. And so we're not using any of the molecules of water, we're using the weight of the water, you know, as it goes downhill. So, you know, we're not, that's the whole point, is that they have to get their water in the right time, condition, and quantity that their right entitles them to, and we're not trying to interfere with that at all.
The Supreme Court agreed, saying that the Freeze didn't own the water, they only had the right to use it. Barbara and Chuck could use the water too, so long as they returned it to the ditch.
And that was actually a real eye-opener to me. I didn't realize what a can of worms we had opened.
Indeed they had. And not just any can of worms. The tangled and complex rules that are Colorado water law. A system that's becoming more and more controversial as the state's population grows and issues like drought and climate change make the resource even more scarce.
I thought it was sort of goofy.
That's Bill Padock, a well-respected water lawyer. We asked him to weigh in on the Supreme Court's decision.
It's I guess, what you would call judicial legislation, because it authorizes a new class of water rights that didn't previously exist.
A new right that says, sure, you can jump in line and use water already appropriated to someone else as long as you don't hurt that owner. A decision that seemingly contradicts the intent of the current structure.
According to Padock, this is new and potentially threatening to the entire system.
It was, you know, really a leap into uncharted territory by the court, and will probably result in a lot more litigation in the future over how you address the rights of these junior, what I would call a piggyback appropriation.
But there it is. Barbara and Chuck are proud owners of a new water right, and the next step is to build their system.
We follow Chuck and Barbara across a field near their house to see the creek they plan to use. It feels a bit Ironic. The ditch at the center of this decision, it's surprisingly tiny.
So how wide would you estimate the ditch to be here?
Oh, you know, I'd say it's a foot wide and in general, and maybe another foot deep.
And the waterfall that would generate the power, it tumbles a mere few inches. Small that it is, though, this little trench could be huge in terms of what it portends for the future of Colorado water law. Reporting from the San Luis Valley in southern Colorado, I'm Franny Halperin.
And I'm Jamie Sudler, and you're listening to H2O Radio.
H2O Radio is based in Denver and provides public awareness about the West's most precious resource. And finally, the Redstone Castle goes on the auction block for $2 million on October 7th. The Glenwood Springs Post-Independent reports that Florida-based Platinum Luxury Auctions is in charge of the event. The reserve price is half of what the castle's current owner paid in 2005 and less than a third of the $7.5 million listing from last summer. Mining magnate John C. Osgood opened the castle as the Cleveholm Manor in 1902. The 23,000-square-foot home is surrounded by 150 acres. For KDNK News, I'm Amy Haddon Marsh.
Arkansas has dropped slightly on this Monday morning from 330 to 323 cubic feet per second. And as far as the Colorado goes, Ruby and Horse Thief Canyon down to 3770 from 3880 on Friday. Glenwood Springs Whitewater Park now below the 2000 CFS level to 1970. Grizzly Creek from 1350 to 1340. The Crystal is now below 80, trickling along at 78 CFS, down from Friday's total of 86 and 95 on Thursday. The Roaring Fork, 694 on Friday, and a couple days before that as well. Now down to 676, so still going strong. It was kind of a warm and dry weekend. We expect a warm and dry week for the most part. But things will be cooling down by the end. Check this out. We do have a shower possibility tomorrow, 10 to 20%. Carbondale, 84 degrees for our high today, then 81 tomorrow with a 10% chance of showers tomorrow by day, 20% by night. 76 Wednesday, 76 Thursday, but then 63 degrees. That's a precipitous drop, Stacy Stein.
Burr.
On Friday. And Rifle and Glenwood Springs, 87 degrees today. They'll be in the mid-60s, 66 and 67, respectively, on Friday. So we do have a change coming. You'd think summer would be changing to fall.